Child, how can you stop me? With a smile of utmost kindness, he said, I'd have you garrotted if it came to that. Shocked silence held her for a moment, and Paul sensed Chaney listening behind the heavy draperies into their private apartments. I am your wife, Irulan whispered. Let us not play these silly games, he said. You play a part, no more. We both know who my wife is. And I am a convenience, nothing more, she said, voice heavy with bitterness. I have no wish to be cruel to you, he said. You chose me for this position. Not I, he said. Fate chose you. Your father chose you. The Bene Gesserit chose you. The Guild chose you, and they have chosen you once more. For what have they chosen you, Irulan? Why can't I have your child? Because that's a role for which you weren't chosen. It's my right to bear the royal heir. My father was, your father was and is, a beast. We both know he'd lost almost all touch with the humanity he was supposed to rule and protect. Was he hated less than you're hated? She flared. A good question, he agreed, a sardonic smile touching the edges of his mouth. You say you've no wish to be cruel to me, yet, and that's why I agree that you can take any lover you choose. But understand me well. Take a lover, but bring no sour-fathered child into my household. I would deny such a child. I don't begrudge you any male alliance as long as you are discreet and childless. I'd be silly to feel otherwise under the circumstances, but don't presume upon this license which I freely bestow. Where the throne is concerned, I control what blood is heir to it. The Bene Gesserit doesn't control this, nor does the Guild. This is one of the privileges I won when I smashed your father's Sardaukar legions out there on the plain of Arrakeen. It's on your head, then, Irulan said. She whirled and swept out of the chamber. Remembering the encounter now, Paul brought his awareness out of it and focused on Chaney, seated beside him on their bed. He could understand his ambivalent feelings about Irulan, understand Chaney's Fremen decision. Under other circumstances, Chaney and Irulan might have been friends. What have you decided? Chaney asked. No child, he said. Chaney made the Fremen Chrisknife sign with the index finger and thumb of her right hand. It could come to that, he agreed. You don't think a child would solve anything with Irulan? She asked. Only a fool would think that. I am not a fool, my love. Anger possessed him. I never said you were. But this isn't some damned romantic novel we're discussing. That's a real princess down the hall. She was raised in all the nasty intrigues of an imperial court. Plotting is as natural to her as writing her stupid histories. They're not stupid, love. Probably not. He brought his anger under control, took her hand in his. Sorry, but that woman has many plots, plots within plots. Give in to one of her ambitions and you could advance another of them. Her voice mild, Chaney said, Haven't I always said as much? Yes, of course you have. He stared at her. Then what are you really trying to say to me? She lay down beside him, placed her head against his neck. They have come to a decision on how to fight you, she said. Irulan reeks of secret decisions. Paul stroked her hair. Chaney had peeled away the dross. Terrible purpose brushed him. It was a Coriolis wind in his soul. It whistled through the framework of his being. His body knew things then never learned in consciousness. Chaney, beloved, he whispered, do you know what I'd spend to end the jihad? To separate myself from the damnable godhead the Khizerat forces onto me? She trembled. You have but to command it, she said. Oh, no, even if I died now, my name would still lead them. When I think of the Atreides' name tied to this religious butchery. But you're the Emperor. I'm a figurehead. When Godhead's given, that's the one thing the so-called God no longer controls. A bitter laugh shook him. He sensed the future looking back at him out of dynasties not even dreamed. He felt his being cast out, crying. Unchained from the rings of fate. Only his name continued. I was chosen, he said, perhaps at birth, certainly before I had much say in it. I was chosen.
Then unchoose, she said.
His arm tightened around her shoulder.
In time, beloved, give me yet a little time.
Unshed tears burned his eyes.
We should return to see its Tabor,
Cheney said.
There's too much to contend with in this tent of stone. He nodded, his chin moving against the smooth fabric of the scarf which covered her hair. The soothing spice smell of her filled his nostrils.
See it.
The ancient Chocobsa word absorbed him. A place of retreat and safety in a time of peril. Cheney's suggestion made him long for vistas of open sand, for clean distances where one could see an enemy coming from a long way off. The tribes expect Muad'Dib to return to them, she said. She lifted her head to look at him. You belong to us.
I belong to a vision, he whispered.
He thought then of the jihad, of the Jenny mingling across the parsecs, and the vision which told him how he might end it. Should he pay the price? All the hatefulness would evaporate, dying as fires die, ember by ember. But, oh, the terrifying price!
I never wanted to be a god, he thought. I wanted only to disappear like a jewel of traced dew, caught by the morning. I wanted to escape the angels and the damned, alone, as though by an oversight.
Will we go back to the Siege? Cheney pressed.
Yes, he whispered, and he thought, I must pay the price.
Cheney heaved a deep sigh, settled back against him. I've loitered, he thought, and he saw how he'd been hemmed in by boundaries of love and the jihad. And what was one life, no matter how beloved, against all the lives the jihad was certain to take? Could single misery be weighed against the agony of multitudes?
Love?
Cheney said, questioning. He put a hand against her lips. I'll yield up myself, he thought. I'll rush out while I yet have the strength, fly through a space a bird might not find. It was a useless thought, and he knew it. The jihad would follow his ghost. What could he answer? He wondered. How explain when people taxed him with brutal foolishness? Who might understand? I wanted only to look back and say, There's an existence which couldn't hold me. See, I vanish. No restraint or net of human devising can trap me ever again. I renounce my religion. This glorious instant is mine. I'm free.
What empty words.
A big worm was seen below the shield wall yesterday, Cheney said. More than 100 meters long, they say. Such big ones come rarely into this region anymore. The water repels them, I suppose. They say this one came to summon Muad'Dib home to his desert. She pinched his chest. Don't laugh at me.
I'm not laughing.
Paul, caught by wonder at the persistent Fremen mythos, felt a heart constriction, a thing inflicted upon his lifeline. Adab, the demanding memory. He recalled his childhood room on Caladan then, dark night in the stone chamber, a vision. It had been one of his earliest prescient moments. He felt his mind dive into the vision, saw through a veiled cloud memory, vision within vision, a line of Fremen, their robes trimmed with dust. They paraded past a gap in tall rocks. They carried a long, cloth-wrapped burden. And Paul heard himself say in the vision, it was mostly sweet, but you were the sweetest of all.
Adab released him.
You're so quiet, Cheney whispered. What is it?
Paul shuddered, sat up, face averted. You're angry because I've been to the desert's edge, Cheney said. He shook his head without speaking.
I only went because I want a child, Cheney said.
Paul was unable to speak. He felt himself consumed by the raw power of that early vision. Terrible purpose. In that moment, his whole life was a limb shaken by the departure of a bird. And the bird was chance. Free will. I succumbed to the lore of the oracle, he thought. And he sensed that succumbing to this lore might be to fix himself upon a single-track life. Could it be, he wondered, that the Oracle didn't tell the future? Could it be that the Oracle made the future? Had he exposed his life to some web of underlying threads, trapped himself there in that long-ago awakening, victim of a spider future which even now advanced upon him with terrifying jaws? A Bene Gesserit axiom slipped into his mind. To use raw power is to make yourself infinitely vulnerable to greater powers. I know it angers you, Chaney said, touching his arm. It's true that the tribes have revived the old rites and the blood sacrifices, but I took no part in those. Paul inhaled a deep, trembling breath. The torrent of his vision dissipated, became a deep, still place whose currents moved with absorbing power beyond his reach. Please, Chaney begged. I want a child, our child. Is that a terrible thing? Paul caressed her arm where she touched him, pulled away. He climbed from the bed, extinguished the glow globes, crossed to the balcony window, opened the draperies. The deep desert could not intrude here except by its odors. A windowless wall climbed to the night sky across from him. Moonlight slanted down into an enclosed garden, sentinel trees and broad leaves, wet foliage. He could see a fish pond reflecting stars among the leaves, pockets of white floral brilliance in the shadows. Momentarily, he saw the garden through Fremen eyes, alien, menacing, dangerous in its waste of water. He thought of the water sellers, their way destroyed by the lavish dispensing from his hands. They hated him. He'd slain the past. And there were others, even those who'd fought for the souls to buy precious water, who hated him for changing the old ways. As the ecological pattern dictated by Muad'Dib remade the planet's landscape, human resistance increased. Was it not presumptuous, he wondered, to think he could make over an entire planet, everything growing where and how he told it to grow? Even if he succeeded, what of the universe waiting out there? Did it fear similar treatment? Abruptly, he closed the draperies, sealed the ventilators. He turned toward Chaney in the darkness, felt her waiting there. Her water rings tinkled like the alms bells of pilgrims. He groped his way to the sound, encountered her outstretched arms. Beloved, she whispered, have I troubled you? Her arms enclosed his future as they enclosed him. Not you, he said. Oh, not you.
The advent of the field process shield and the las gun, with their explosive interaction, deadly to attacker and attacked, placed the current determinatives on weapons technology. We need not go into the special role of atomics. The fact that any family in my empire could so deploy its atomics as to destroy the planetary bases of 50 or more other families caused some nervousness, true, but all of us possess precautionary plans for devastating retaliation. Guild and Lanthrot contain the keys which hold this force in check. No, my concern goes to the development of humans as special weapons. Here is a virtually unlimited field which a few powers are developing. Muad'Dib, Lecture to the War College, from the Stilgar Chronicle. The old man stood in his doorway peering out with blue-in-blue eyes. The eyes were veiled by that native suspicion all desert folk held for strangers. Bitter lines tortured the edges of his mouth where it could be seen through a fringe of white beard. He wore no stillsuit, and it said much that he ignored this fact in the full knowledge of the moisture pouring from his house through the open door. Sightale bowed, gave the greeting signal of the conspiracy. From somewhere behind the old man came the sound of a rebec wailing through the atonal dissonance of Semuta music. The old man's manner carried no drug dullness, an indication that Semuta was the weakness of another. It seemed strange to Sightale, though, to find that sophisticated vice in this place.
"Greetings from afar," Sightale said, smiling through the flat-featured face he had chosen for this encounter.
It occurred to him then that this old man might recognize the chosen face. Some of the older Fremen here on Dune had known Duncan Idaho. The choice of features which he had thought amusing might have been a mistake, Sightale decided, but he dared not change the face out here. He cast nervous glances up and down the street. Would the old man never invite him inside?
Did you know my son? The old man asked.
That, at least, was one of the countersigns. Saitel made the proper response, all the time keeping his eyes alert for any suspicious circumstance in his surroundings. He did not like his position here. The street was a cul-de-sac ending in this house. The houses all around had been built for veterans of the jihad. They formed a suburb of Arakeen which stretched into the imperial basin past Tiamag. The walls which hemmed in this street presented blank faces of dun plasmeld, broken by dark shadows of sealed doorways and here and there scrawled obscenities. Beside this very door someone had chalked a pronouncement that one Beris had brought back to Arrakis a loathsome disease which deprived him of his manhood.
"Do you come in partnership?" the old man asked.
"Alone," Saitel said. The old man cleared his throat, still hesitating in that maddening way. Saitel cautioned himself to patience. Contact in this fashion carried its own dangers. Perhaps the old man knew some reason for carrying on this way. It was the proper hour, though. The pale sun stood almost directly overhead. People of this quarter remained sealed in their houses to sleep through the hot part of the day. Was it the new neighbour who bothered the old man, Saitel wondered. The adjoining house, he knew, had been assigned to Othaim, once a member of Muad'Dib's dreaded Fadaikin death commandos, and Bijaz, the catalyst dwarf, waited with Othaim. Saitel returned his gaze to the old man, noted the empty sleeve dangling from the left shoulder and the lack of a stillsuit. An air of command hung about this old man. He'd been no foot slogger in the jihad.
"May I know the visitor's name?"
the old man asked. Saitel suppressed a sigh of relief. He was to be accepted, after all.
"I am Zal," he said, giving the name assigned him for this mission. "I am Farouk," the old man said, "once Bashar of the 9th Legion in the jihad. Does this mean anything to you?"
Saitel read menace in the words, said, "You were born in Siet Tabor, with allegiance to Stilgar." Farouk relaxed, stepped aside.
"You are welcome in my house."
Saitel slipped past him into a shadowy atrium, blue tile floor, glittering designs worked in crystal on the walls. Beyond the atrium was a covered courtyard. Light admitted by translucent filters spread an opalescence as silvery as the white night of first moon. The street door grated into its moisture seals behind him.
"We were a noble people," Farouk said,
leading the way toward the courtyard.
"We were not of the cast out. We lived in no graben village such as this. We had a proper siege in the shield wall above Habanya Ridge. One worm could carry us into Kadem, the inner desert."
"Not like this," Saitel agreed, realizing now what had brought Farouk into the conspiracy. The Fremen longed for the old days and the old ways. They entered the courtyard. Farouk struggled with an intense dislike for his visitor, Saitel realized. Fremen distrusted eyes that were not the total blue of the Abad. Off-worlders, Fremen said, had unfocused eyes which saw things they were not supposed to see. The Samuta music had stopped at their entrance. It was replaced now by the strum of a balisette, first a 9-scale chord, then the clear notes of a song which was popular on the Naraj worlds. As his eyes adjusted to the light, Saitel saw a youth sitting cross-legged on a low divan beneath arches to his right. The youth's eyes were empty sockets. With that uncanny facility of the blind, he began singing the moment Saitel focused on him. The voice was high and sweet. "A wind has blown the land away, and blown the sky away, and all the men. Who is this wind? The trees stand unbent, drinking where men drank. I've known too many worlds, too many men, too many trees, too many winds." Those were not the original words of the song, Saitel noted. Farouk led him away from the youth and under the arches of the opposite side, indicated cushions scattered over the tile floor. The tile was worked into designs of sea creatures.
There is a cushion once occupied in Sietch by Muad'Dib, Farouk said, indicating a round black mound. It is yours now.
I am in your debt, Saitel said, sinking to the black mound. He smiled. Farouk displayed wisdom. A sage spoke of loyalty even while listening to songs of hidden meaning and words with secret messages. Who could deny the terrifying powers of the tyrant emperor? Inserting his words across the song without breaking the meter, Farouk said,
Does my son's music disturb you?
Saitel gestured to a cushion facing him, put his back against a cool pillar.
I enjoy music.
My son lost his eyes in the conquest of Narraj, Farouk said. He was nursed there and should have stayed. No woman of the people will have him thus. I find it curious, though, to know I have grandchildren on Narraj that I may never see. Do you know the Narraj worlds, Zal?
In my youth, I toured there with a troop of my fellow face dancers, Saitel said.
You are a face dancer, then, Farouk said. I had wondered at your features. They reminded me of a man I knew here once.
Duncan Idaho?
That one, yes. The swordmaster in the Emperor's pay.
He was killed, so it is said.
So it is said, Farouk agreed. Are you truly a man, then? I've heard stories about face dancers that...
He shrugged. We are Jadasha hermaphrodites, Saitel said. Either sex at will. For the present, I am a man.
Farouk pursed his lips in thought, then...
May I call for refreshments? Do you desire water? Iced fruit?
Talk will suffice, Saitel said.
The guest's wish is a command, Farouk said, settling to the cushion which faced Saitel.
Blessed is Abu Dudur, father of the indefinite roads of time, Saitel said, and he thought, There. I've told him straight out that I come from a guild of steersmen and wear the steersman's concealment.
Thrice blessed, Farouk said, holding his hands into his lap in the ritual clasp.
They were old, heavily veined hands. An object seen from a distance betrays only its principal, Saitel said, revealing that he wished to discuss the Emperor's fortress keep.
That which is dark and evil may be seen for evil at any distance, Farouk said, advising delay.
Why? Saitel wondered. But he said, How did your son lose his eyes?
The Narraj defenders used a stone burner, Farouk said. My son was too close. Cursed atomics. Even the stone burner should be outlawed.
It skirts the intent of the law, Saitel agreed, and he thought, A stone burner on Narraj? We weren't told of that. Why does this old man speak of stone burners here?
I offered to buy Tlelaxu eyes for him from your masters, Farouk said. But there's a story in the legions that Tlelaxu eyes enslave their users. My son told me that such eyes are metal, and he is flesh, that such a union must be sinful.
The principle of an object must fit its original intent. Saitel said, trying to turn the conversation back to the information he sought. Farouk's lips went thin, but he nodded.
Speak openly of what you wish, he said. We must put our trust in your steersman.
Have you ever entered the Imperial Keep? Saitel asked.
I was there for the feast celebrating the Molitor victory. It was cold in all that stone, despite the best Ixion space heaters. We slept on the terrace of Alia's fane the night before. He has trees in there, you know, trees from many worlds. We Bashars were dressed in our finest green robes and had our tables set apart. We ate and drank too much. I was disgusted with some of the things I saw. The walking wounded came, dragging themselves along on their crutches. I do not think our Muad'Dib knows how many men he has maimed.
You objected to the feast? Saitel asked, speaking from a knowledge of the Fremen orgies which were ignited by spice beer.
It was not like the mingling of our souls in the siege, Farouk said. There was no Dao. For entertainment the troops had slave girls, and the men shared the stories of their battles and their wounds.
So you were inside that great pile of stone, Saitel said.
Muad'Dib came out to us on the terrace, Farouk said.
Good fortune to us all, he said. The greeting drill of the desert in that place.
Do you know the location of his private apartments? Saitel asked.
Deep inside, Farouk said. Somewhere deep inside. I am told he and Chaney live a nomadic life, and that all within the walls of their keep. Out to the great hall he comes for the public audiences. He has reception halls and formal meeting places, a whole wing for his personal guard, places for the ceremonies, and an inner section for communications. There is a room far beneath his fortress, I am told, where he keeps a stunted worm surrounded by a water moat with which to poison it. Here is where he reads the future.
Myth, all tangled up with facts, Saitel thought.
The apparatus of government accompanies him everywhere, Farouk grumbled. Clerks and attendants for the attendants. He trusts only the ones such as Stilgar, who were very close to him in the old days.
Not you, Saitel said.
I think he has forgotten my existence, Farouk said.
How does he come and go when he leaves that building? Saitel asked.
He has a tiny thopter landing which juts from an inner wall, Farouk said. I am told Muad'Dib will not permit another to handle the controls for a landing there. It requires an approach, so it is said, where the slightest miscalculation would plunge him down a sheer cliff of wall into one of his accursed gardens.
Saitel nodded. This, most likely, was true. Such an aerial entry to the Emperor's quarters would carry a certain measure of security. The Atreides were superb pilots all.
He uses men to carry his distrans messages, Farouk said. It demeans men to implant wave translators in them. A man's voice should be his own to command. It should not carry another man's message hidden within its sounds.
Saitel shrugged. All great powers used the distrans in this age. One could never tell what obstacle might be placed between sender and addressee. The distrans defied political cryptology because it relied on subtle distortions of natural sound patterns which could be scrambled with enormous intricacy.
Even his tax officials use this method, Farouk complained. In my day, the distrans was implanted only in the lower animals.
But revenue information must be kept secret, Saitel thought. More than one government has fallen because people discovered the real extent of official wealth. How do the Fremen cohorts feel now about Muad'Dib's jihad? Saitel asked. Do they object to making a god out of their emperor?
Most of them don't even consider this, Farouk said. They think of the jihad the way I thought of it, most of them. It is a source of strange experiences, adventure, or wealth. This Graben hovel in which I live, Farouk gestured at the courtyard, it cost 60 liters of spice, 90 kontars. There was a time when I could not even imagine such riches.
He shook his head. Across the courtyard, the blind youth took up the notes of a love ballad on his baliset. 90 contars, Sytale thought. How strange. Great riches, certainly. Farouk's hovel would be a palace on many another world. But all things were relative, even the contar. Did Farouk, for example, know whence came his measure for this weight of spice? Did he ever think to himself that 1.5 contar once limited a camel load? Not likely. Farouk might never even have heard of a camel, or of the golden age of earth. His words oddly in rhythm to the melody of his son's balisad, Farouk said,
I owned a kris knife, water rings to 10 liters, my own lance which had been my father's, a coffee service, a bottle made of red glass older than any memory in my siege. I had my own share of our spice, but no money. I was rich and did not know it. 2 wives I had, one plain and dear to me, the other stupid and obstinate, but with form and face of an angel. I was a Fremen Naib, a rider of worms, master of the Leviathan and of the sand.
The youth across the courtyard picked up the beat of his melody.
I knew many things without the need to think about them, Farouk said. I knew there was water far beneath our sand, held there in bondage by the little makers. I knew that my ancestors sacrificed virgins to Shaihulud before Liet Gaines made us stop. It was wrong of us to stop. I had seen the jewels in the mouth of a worm. My soul had 4 gates, and I knew them all.
He fell silent, musing. Then the Atreides came with his witch mother, Sytale said.
The Atreides came, Farouk agreed. The one we named Usul in our siege, his private name among us, our Muad'Dib, our Mahdi. And when he called for the jihad, I was one of those who asked, why should I go to fight there? I have no relatives there. But other men went, young men, friends, companions of my childhood. When they returned, they spoke of wizardry, of the power in this Atreides savior. He fought our enemy, the Harkonnen. Liet Gaines, who had promised us a paradise upon our planet, blessed him. It was said this Atreides came to change our world and our universe, that he was the man to make the golden flower blossom in the night.
Farouk held up his hands, examined the palms.
Men pointed to first moon and said, his soul is there. Thus he was called Muad'Dib. I did not understand all this.
He lowered his hands, stared across the courtyard at his son.
I had no thoughts in my head. There were thoughts only in my heart and my belly and my loins.
Again the tempo of the background music increased.
Do you know why I enlisted in the jihad?
The old eyes stared hard at Sytale.
I heard there was a thing called a sea. It is very hard to believe in a sea when you have lived only here among our dunes. We have no seas. Men of Dune had never known a sea. We had our wind traps. We collected water for the great change Liet Kynes promised us, this great change Muad'Dib is bringing with a wave of his hand. I could imagine a canal, water flowing across the land in a canal. From this, my mind could picture a river, but a sea.
Farouk gazed at the translucent cover of his courtyard as though trying to probe into the universe beyond.
A sea,
he said, voice low.
It was too much for my mind to picture. Yet men I knew said they had seen this marvel. I thought they lied, but I had to know for myself. It was for this reason that I enlisted.
The youth struck a loud, final chord on the baliset, took up a new song with an oddly undulating rhythm. Did you find your sea? Saitel asked. Farouk remained silent, and Saitel thought the old man had not heard. The Baliset music rose around them and fell like a tidal movement. Farouk breathed to its rhythm.
There was a sunset, Farouk said presently. One of the elder artists might have painted such a sunset. It had red in it, the colour of the glass in my bottle. There was gold, blue. It was on the world they call Enfail, the one where I led my legion to victory. We came out of a mountain pass where the air was sick with water. I could scarcely breathe it. And there below me was the thing my friends had told me about. Water, as far as I could see and farther. We marched down to it. I waded out into it and drank. It was bitter and made me ill. But the wonder of it has never left me.
Saitel found himself sharing the old Fremen's awe.
I immersed myself in that sea, Farouk said, looking down at the water creatures worked into the tiles of his floor. One man sank beneath that water. Another man arose from it. I felt that I could remember a past which had never been. I stared around me with eyes that could accept anything, anything at all. I saw a body in the water, one of the defenders we had slain. There was a log nearby supported on that water, a piece of a great tree. I can close my eyes now and see that log. It was black on one end from a fire, and there was a piece of cloth in that water, no more than a yellow rag, torn, dirty. I looked at all these things, and I understood why they had come to this place. It was for me to see them.
Farouk turned slowly, stared into Saitel's eyes.
The universe is unfinished, you know, he said.
This one is garrulous, but deep, Saitel thought.
And he said, I can see it made a profound impression on you.
You are a Tlelaxu, Farouk said. You have seen many seas. I have seen only this one, yet I know a thing about seas which you do not.
Saitel found himself in the grip of an odd feeling of disquiet.
The mother of chaos was born in a sea, Farouk said. A Kizara Tafweed stood nearby when I came dripping from that water. He had not entered the sea. He stood on the sand. It was wet sand, with some of my men who shared his fear. He watched me with eyes that knew I had learned something which was denied to him. I had become a sea creature, and I frightened him. The sea healed me of the jihad, and I think he saw this.
Saitel realized that somewhere in this recital the music had stopped. He found it disturbing that he could not place the instant when the Baliset had fallen silent. As though it were relevant to what he'd been recounting, Farouk said,
Every gate is guarded. There is no way into the Emperor's fortress.
That's its weakness, Saitel said. Farouk stretched his neck upward, peering. There's a way in, Saitel explained. The fact that most men, including, we may hope, the Emperor, believe otherwise, that's to our advantage. He rubbed his lips, feeling the strangeness of the visage he'd chosen. The musician's silence bothered him. Did it mean Farouk's son was through transmitting? That had been the way of it, naturally. The message condensed and transmitted within the music. It had been impressed upon Saitel's own neural system, there to be triggered at the proper moment by the distrans embedded in his adrenal cortex. If it was ended, he had become a container of unknown words. He was a vessel, sloshing with data. Every cell of the conspiracy here on Arrakis, every name, every contact phrase, all the vital information. With this information, they could brave Arrakis, capture a sandworm, begin the culture of melange somewhere beyond Muad'Dib's writ. They could break the monopoly as they broke Muad'Dib. They could do many things with this information.
We have the woman here,
Farouk said.
Do you wish to see her now?
I've seen her, Saitel said. I've studied her with care. Where is she? Farouk snapped his fingers. The youth took up his rebeck, drew the bow across it. Semuto music wailed from the strings. As though drawn by the sound, a young woman in a blue robe emerged from a doorway behind the musician. Narcotic dullness filled her eyes, which were the total blue of the Ibad. She was a Fremen, addicted to the spice and now caught by an off-world vice. Her awareness lay deep within the Semuta, lost somewhere and riding the ecstasy of the music.
Othheim's daughter, Farouk said. My son gave her the narcotic in the hope of winning a woman of the people for himself, despite his blindness. As you can see, his victory is empty. Semuta has taken what he hoped to gain.
Her father doesn't know? Saitel asked.
She doesn't even know, Farouk said. My son supplies false memories with which she accounts to herself for her visits. She thinks herself in love with him. This is what her family believes. They are outraged because he is not a complete man, but they won't interfere, of course.
The music trailed away to silence. At a gesture from the musician, the young woman seated herself beside him, bent close to listen as he murmured to her.
What will you do with her?
Farouk asked. Once more, Saitel studied the courtyard. Who else is in this house? He asked.
We are all here now, Farouk said. You've not told me what you'll do with the woman. It is my son who wishes to know.
As though about to answer, Saitel extended his right arm. From the sleeve of his robe, a glistening needle darted, embedded itself in Farouk's neck. There was no outcry, no change of posture. Farouk would be dead in a minute, but he sat unmoving, frozen by the dart's poison. Slowly, Saitel climbed to his feet, crossed to the blind musician. The youth was still murmuring to the young woman when the dart whipped into him. Saitel took the young woman's arm, urged her gently to her feet, shifted his own appearance before she looked at him. She came erect, focused on him.
What is it, Farouk?
She asked.
My son is tired and must rest, Saitel said. Come, we'll go out the back way.
We had such a nice talk, she said. I think I've convinced him to get Tlelaxu eyes. It would make a man of him again.
Haven't I said it many times?
Saitel asked, urging her into a rear chamber. His voice, he noted with pride, matched his features precisely. It unmistakably was the voice of the old Fremen, who certainly was dead by this time. Saitel sighed. It had been done with sympathy, he told himself, and the victims certainly had known their peril. Now, the young woman would have to be given her chance.
Empires do not suffer emptiness of purpose at the time of their creation. It is when they have become established that aims are lost and replaced by vague ritual. Words of Muad'Dib by Princess Irulan. It was going to be a bad session, this meeting of the Imperial Council, Aaliyah realized. She sensed contention gathering force, storing up energy. The way Irulan refused to look at Chaney, Stilgar's nervous shuffling of papers, the scowls Paul directed at Korba, the Kizara. She seated herself at the end of the golden council table so she could look out the balcony windows at the dusty light of the afternoon. Korba, interrupted by her entrance, went on with something he'd been saying to Paul. What I mean, my lord, is that there aren't as many gods as once there were. Aaliyah laughed, throwing her head back. The movement dropped the black hood of her Abba robe. Her features lay exposed, blue in blue spice eyes. Her mother's oval face beneath a cap of bronze hair, small nose, mouth wide and generous. Korba's cheeks went almost the colour of his orange robe. He glared at Aaliyah, an angry gnome, bald and fuming. Do you know what's being said about your brother? He demanded.
I know what's being said about your Kizarat, Aaliyah countered. You're not divines, you're God's spies.
Korba glanced at Paul for support, said, We are sent by the writ of Muad'Dib, that he shall know the truth of his people and they shall know the truth of him.
Spies, Aaliyah said.
Korba pursed his lips in injured silence. Paul looked at his sister, wondering why she provoked Korba. Abruptly, he saw that Aaliyah had passed into womanhood, beautiful with the first blazing innocence of youth. He found himself surprised that he hadn't noticed it until this moment. She was 15, almost 16, a reverend mother without motherhood, virgin priestess, object of fearful veneration for the superstitious masses, Aaliyah of the Knife.
This is not the time or place for your sister's levity, Irulan said.
Paul ignored her, nodded to Korba. The square's full of pilgrims. Go out and lead their prayer.
But they expect you, my lord, Korba said.
Put on your turban, Paul said. They'll never know at this distance. Irulan, smothered irritation at being ignored, watched Korba arise to obey. She had the sudden disquieting thought that Edric might not hide her actions from Aaliyah. What do we really know of this sister? She wondered. Chaney, hands tightly clasped in her lap, glanced across the table at Stilgar, her uncle, Paul's minister of state. Did the old Fremen Naib ever long for the simpler life of his desert siege? She wondered. Stilgar's black hair, she noted, had begun to grey at the edges, but his eyes, beneath heavy brows, remained far-seeing. It was the eagle stare of the wild, and his beard still carried the cat's-tube indentation of life in a stillsuit. Made nervous by Chaney's attention, Stilgar looked around the council chamber. His gaze fell on the balcony window and Korba standing outside. Korba raised outstretched arms for the benediction, and a trick of the afternoon sun cast a red halo onto the window behind him. For a moment, Stilgar saw the court Kizara as a figure crucified on a fiery wheel. Korba lowered his arms, destroyed the illusion, but Stilgar remained shaken by it. His thoughts went in angry frustration to the fawning supplicants waiting in the audience hall, and to the hateful pomp which surrounded Muad'Dib's throne. Convening with the Emperor, one hoped for a fault in him, to find mistakes, Stilgar thought. He felt this might be sacrilege, but wanted it anyway. Distant crowd murmuring entered the chamber as Korba returned. The balcony door thumped into its seals behind him, shutting off the sound. Paul's gaze followed the Kizara. Korba took his seat at Paul's left, dark features composed, eyes glazed by fanaticism. He'd enjoyed that moment of religious power.
The spirit presence has been invoked, he said.
Thank the Lord for that, Aaliyah said.
Korba's lips went white. Again, Paul studied his sister, wondered at her motives. Her innocence masked deception, he told himself. She'd come out of the same Bene Gesserit breeding program as he had. What had the Kwisatz Haderach genetics produced in her? There was always that mysterious difference. She'd been an embryo in the womb when her mother had survived the raw melange poison. Mother and unborn daughter had become reverent mothers simultaneously. But simultaneity didn't carry identity. Of the experience, Aaliyah said that in one terrifying instance she had awakened to consciousness, her memory absorbing the uncounted other lives which her mother was assimilating. I became my mother and all the others, she said. I was unformed, unborn, but I became an old woman then and there. Sensing his thoughts on her, Aaliyah smiled at Paul. His expression softened. How could anyone react to Korba with other than cynical humour, he asked himself. What is more ridiculous than a death commando transformed into a priest? Stilgar tapped his papers. If my liege permits, he said, there are matters urgent and dire.
The Tupili Treaty, Paul asked.
The Guild maintains that we must sign this treaty without knowing the precise location of the Tupili Entente, Stilgar said. They've some support from Landshrad delegates.
What pressures have you brought to bear?
Irulan asked. Those pressures which my emperor has designated for the Zenterprise, Stilgar said. The stiff formality of his reply contained all his disapproval of the princess consort. My lord and husband, Irulan said, turning to Paul, forcing him to acknowledge her. Emphasizing the titular difference in front of Chaney, Paul thought, is a weakness. In such moments he shared Stilgar's dislike for Irulan. But sympathy tempered his emotions. What was Irulan but a Bene Gesserit pawn? Yes, Paul said. Irulan stared at him. If you withheld their mélange... Chaney shook her head in dissent. We tread with caution, Paul said. Tupoli remains the place of sanctuary for defeated great houses. It symbolizes a last resort, a final place of safety for all our subjects. Exposing the sanctuary makes it vulnerable. If they can hide people, they can hide other things, Stilgar rumbled. An army, perhaps, or the beginnings of Mélange culture, which... You don't back people into a corner, Aaliyah said. Not if you want them to remain peaceful. Ruefully, she saw that she'd been drawn into the contention which she'd foreseen. So we've spent 10 years of negotiation for nothing, Irulan said. None of my brother's actions is for nothing, Aaliyah said. Irulan picked up a scribe, gripped it with white-knuckled intensity. Paul saw her marshal emotional control in the Bene Gesserit way, the penetrating inward stare, deep breathing. He could almost hear her repeating the litany. Presently she said, What have we gained? We've kept the guild off balance, Chaney said. We want to avoid a showdown confrontation with our enemies, Aaliyah said. We have no special desire to kill them. There's enough butchery going on under the Atreides banner. She feels it too, Paul thought. Strange what a sense of compelling responsibility they both felt for that brawling, idolatrous universe with its ecstasies of tranquility and wild motion. Must we protect them from themselves, he wondered. They play with nothingness every moment, empty lives, empty words. They ask too much of me. His throat felt tight and full. How many moments would he lose? What suns? What dreams? Was it worth the price his vision had revealed? Who would ask the living of some far distant future? Who would say to them, But for Muad'Dib you would not be here? Denying them their mélange would solve nothing, Chaney said. So the guild's navigators would lose their ability to see into time-space. Your sisters of the Bene Gesserit would lose their truth sense. Some people might die before their time. Communication would break down. Who could be blamed? They wouldn't let it come to that, Irulan said. Wouldn't they? Chaney asked. Why not? Who could blame the guild? They'd be helpless, demonstrably so. We'll sign the treaty as it stands, Paul said. My lord, Stilgar said, concentrating on his hands. There is a question in our minds. Yes? Paul gave the old Fremen his full attention. You have certain powers, Stilgar said. Can you not locate the Entente despite the guild? Powers, Paul thought. Stilgar couldn't just say, you're prescient. Can't you trace a path in the future that leads to Tupoli? Paul looked at the golden surface of the table, always the same problem. How could he express the limits of the inexpressible? Should he speak of fragmentation, the natural destiny of all power? How could someone who'd never experienced the spice change of prescience conceive an awareness containing no localized space-time, no personal image vector, nor associated sensory captives? He looked at Aaliyah, found her attention on Irulan. Aaliyah sensed his movement, glanced at him, nodded toward Irulan. Ah, yes. Any answer they gave would find its way into one of Irulan's special reports to the Bene Gesserit. They never gave up seeking an answer to the Kwisatz Haderach. Stilgar, though, deserved an answer of some kind. For that matter, so did Irulan. The uninitiated tried to conceive of prescience as obeying a natural law, Paul said. He steepled his hands in front of him. But it'd be just as correct to say it's heaven speaking to us. That being able to read the future is a harmonious act of man's being. In other words, prediction is a natural consequence in the wave of the present. It wears the guise of nature, you see. But such powers cannot be used from an attitude that prestates aims and purposes. Does a chip caught in the wave say where it's going? There's no cause and effect in the oracle. Causes become occasions of convections and confluences, places where the currents meet. Accepting prescience, you fill your being with concepts repugnant to the intellect. Your intellectual consciousness therefore rejects them. In rejecting, intellect becomes a part of the processes and is subjugated. You cannot do it, Stilgar asked. Were I to seek Tupali with prescience, Paul said, speaking directly to Irulan, this might hide Tupali.
Chaos, Irulan protested. It has no consistency.
I did say it obeys no natural law, Paul said.
Then there are limits to what you can see or do with your powers, Irulan asked.
Before Paul could answer, Aaliyah said,
Dear Irulan, prescience has no limits. Not consistent. Consistency isn't a necessary aspect of the universe. But he said, how can my brother give you explicit information about the limits of something which has no limits? The boundaries escape the intellect.
That was a nasty thing for Aaliyah to do, Paul thought. It would alarm Irulan, who had such a careful consciousness, so dependent upon values derived from precise limits. His gaze went to Korba, who sat in a pose of religious reverie, listening with the soul.
How could the Kizarat use this exchange?
More religious mystery, something to evoke awe, no doubt.
Then you'll sign the treaty in its present form, Stilgar asked.
Paul smiled. The issue of the oracle by Stilgar's judgment had been closed. Stilgar aimed only at victory, not at discovering truth. Peace, justice, and a sound coinage, these anchored Stilgar's universe. He wanted something visible and real, a signature on a treaty.
I'll sign it, Paul said.
Stilgar took up a fresh folder.
The latest communication from our field commanders in Sector Ixion speaks of agitation for a constitution.
The old Fremen glanced at Chaney, who shrugged. Irulan, who had closed her eyes and put both hands to her forehead in mnemonic impressment, opened her eyes, studied Paul intently.
The Ixion Confederacy offers submission, Stilgar said. But the negotiators question the amount of the imperial tax, which they...
They want a legal limit to my imperial will, Paul said.
Who would govern me? The Landsraad or Choam?
Stilgar removed from the folder a note on Instroy paper.
One of our agents sent this memorandum from a caucus of the Choam minority.
He read the cipher in a flat voice.
The throne must be stopped in its attempt at a power monopoly. We must tell the truth about the Atreides, how he maneuvers behind the triple sham of Landsraad legislation, religious sanction, and bureaucratic efficiency.
He pushed the note back into the folder.
A constitution, Chaney murmured.
Paul glanced at her, back to Stilgar. Thus the jihad falters, Paul thought. But not soon enough to save me. The thought produced emotional tensions. He remembered his earliest visions of the jihad to be, the terror and revulsion he'd experienced. Now, of course, he knew visions of greater terrors. He had lived with the real violence. He had seen his Fremen, charged with mystical strength, sweep all before them in the religious war. The jihad gained a new perspective. It was finite, of course, a brief spasm when measured against eternity, but beyond lay horrors to overshadow anything in the past.
All in my name, Paul thought.
Perhaps they could be given the form of a constitution, Chaney suggested. It needn't be actual.
Deceit is a tool of statecraft, Irulan agreed. There are limits to power, as those who put their hopes in a constitution always discover, Paul said.
Korba straightened from his reverent pose.
M'lord?
Yes? And Paul thought, here now. Here's one who may harbour secret sympathies for an imagined rule of law.
We could begin with a religious constitution, Korba said. Something for the faithful who...
No, Paul snapped. We will make this an order in council. Are you recording this, Irulan?
Yes, my lord,
Irulan said, voice frigid with dislike for the menial role he forced upon her. Constitutions become the ultimate tyranny, Paul said. They are organized power on such a scale as to be overwhelming. The Constitution is a social power mobilized, and it has no conscience. It can crush the highest and the lowest, removing all dignity and individuality. It has an unstable balance point and no limitations. I, however, have limitations. In my desire to provide an ultimate protection for my people, I forbid a constitution. Order in council, this date, etc., etc.
What of the Ixion concern about the tax, my lord? Stilgar asked.
Paul, forced his attention away from the brooding, angry look on Corba's face, said, You've a proposal still?
We must have control of taxes, sire.
Our price to the guild for my signature on the Tupoli Treaty, Paul said, is the submission of the Ixion Confederacy to our tax. The Confederacy cannot trade without guild transport.
They'll pay. Very good, my lord.
Stilgar produced another folder, cleared his throat.
The Kizerat's report on Seleucus Secundus.
Irulan's father has been putting his legions through landing manoeuvres.
Irulan found something of interest in the palm of her left hand. A pulse throbbed at her neck.
Irulan, Paul asked, do you persist in arguing that your father's one legion is nothing more than a toy?
What could he do with only one legion? She asked.
She stared at him out of slitted eyes.
He could get himself killed, Chaney said.
Paul nodded, and I'd be blamed.
I know a few commanders in the Jihad, Aaliyah said, who'd pounce if they learned of this.
But it's only his police force, Irulan protested.
Then they have no need for landing manoeuvres, Paul said. I suggest that your next little note to your father contain a frank and direct discussion of my views about his delicate position. She lowered her gaze.
Yes, my lord. I hope that will be the end of it. My father would make a good martyr.
Paul said. My sister wouldn't send a message to those commanders she mentioned unless I ordered it.
An attack on my father carries dangers other than the obvious military ones, Irulan said. People are beginning to look back on his reign with a certain nostalgia.
You'll go too far one day, Chaney said in her deadly serious Fremen voice.
Enough, Paul ordered.
He weighed Irulan's revelation about public nostalgia.
Ah, now, that carried a note of truth. Once more, Irulan had proved her worth.
The Bene Gesserit send a formal supplication, Stilgar said, presenting another folder. They wish to consult you about the preservation of your bloodline.
Chaney glanced sideways at the folder as though it contained a deadly device.
Send the sisterhood the usual excuses, Paul said.
Must we? Irulan demanded.
Perhaps this is the time to discuss it, Chaney said.
Paul shook his head sharply. They couldn't know that this was part of the price he had not yet decided to pay. But Chaney wasn't to be stopped.
I have been to the prayer wall of Siach Tabor, where I was born, she said.
I have submitted to doctors. I have knelt in the desert and sent my thoughts into the depths where dwells Shai'ulud.
Yet, she shrugged, nothing avails. Science and superstition all have failed her, Paul thought. Do I fail her too by not telling her what bearing an heir to House Atreides will precipitate? He looked up to find an expression of pity in Aaliyah's eyes. The idea of pity from his sister repelled him. Had she too seen that terrifying future?
My lord must know the dangers to his realm when he has no heir, Irulan said, using her Bene Gesserit powers of voice with an oily persuasiveness.
These things are naturally difficult to discuss, but they must be brought into the open. An emperor is more than a man. His figure leads the realm. Should he die without an heir, civil strife must follow. As you love your people, you cannot leave them thus.
Paul pushed himself away from the table, strode to the balcony windows. A wind was flattening the smoke of the city's fires out there.
The sky presented a darkening silver blue, softened by the evening fall of dust from the shield wall. He stared southward at the escarpment which protected his northern lands from the Coriolis wind, and he wondered why his own peace of mind could find no such shield. The council sat silently waiting behind him, aware of how close to rage he was. Paul sensed time rushing upon him. He tried to force himself into a tranquillity of many balances where he might shape a new future.
"Disengage, disengage, disengage," he thought.
What would happen if he took Chaney, just picked up and left with her, sought sanctuary on Tupeli? His name would remain behind. The jihad would find new and more terrible centres upon which to turn. He'd be blamed for that too. He felt suddenly fearful that in reaching for any new thing, he might let fall what was most precious, that even the slightest noise from him might send the universe crashing back, receding until he never could recapture any piece of it. Below him, the square had become the setting for a band of pilgrims in the green and white of the Hajj. They wended their way like a disjointed snake behind a striding Arakeen guide. They reminded Paul that his reception hall would be packed with supplicants by now. Pilgrims. Their exercise in homelessness had become a disgusting source of wealth for his Imperium. The Hajj filled the spaceways with religious tramps. They came, and they came, and they came. How did I set this in motion? He asked himself. It had, of course, set itself in motion. It was in the genes which might labour for centuries to achieve this brief spasm. Driven by that deepest religious instinct, the people came seeking their resurrection. The pilgrimage ended here. Arrakis, the place of rebirth, the place to die. Snide old Fremen said he wanted the pilgrims for their water. What was it the pilgrims really sought? Paul wondered. They said they came to a holy place, but they must know the universe contained no Eden source, no Tupeli for the soul. They called Arrakis the place of the unknown, where all mysteries were explained. This was a link between their universe and the next, and the frightening thing was that they appeared to go away satisfied. What do they find here? Paul asked himself.